a system that was designed to be highly decentralized and was resilient to a lot of centralizing forces became less resilient to centralizing forces when the money became entirely co-opted. And so my view of it is, before we throw the baby out with the bathwater, let's fix the money. Let's take the fly out of the ointment. Let's see where the chips fall and then figure out what else we need to change. They can relate to it and they can say, yep, that makes a lot more sense to me based on everything that I've lived in the world. There is actually something, there's a vehicle that if those ideas make more sense to me, I can actually opt into it.
You're listening to the Wake Up Podcast with Alex Fetsky, the place where the most dynamic thinkers and practitioners in the world drop truth bombs and contrarian viewpoints to help you become the best version of yourself. Find us on the Fountain app and send us a boost with a comment. Parker Lewis, author of the Gradually Then Suddenly series, who you'll know from Unchained and the Bitcoin Commons, joins me today to discuss his new piece for the Bitcoin Times, alongside his journey into Austrian economics and a couple tougher questions I had for him around governance and the state and libertarianism and things like that. So check it out, and of course go grab a copy of the Bitcoin Times. The collectible is available, it's on sale now, and it's shipping the first week of the new year. Edition 3 and 4 are shipping now. You can also get a low-res PDF for free if you pop your email in. And if you want to support us and the work that we're doing, you can actually tip some sats. It's like a tiny amount of Bitcoin, and you can get a beautiful high-res copy, digital copy for yourself. So anyway, thank you obviously to Unchained, Riot, Silvergate, and Fold for making this all possible. And let's get on with the episode, Bitcoin, Governance, Gulags, and the Future. Welcome, everyone. Episode number 99 of the Wake Up Podcast. And actually, the last time I had this guest on was, I just realized, episode 21. So it was actually a lucky number. Oh. I didn't even realize that until I checked. So Mr. Parker Lewis.
I did not know that either, man. It's been a long time.
Yeah, it has, man. It was actually, we did it in, I think it actually was December.
99. I mean, those are two good numbers.
Very good numbers. So it was, I think it was actually almost exactly 2 years ago, because I remember I was in Germany, and if you remember, there was I was recording in this kind of apartment. There was that chick that was trying to crawl down the steps.
Yeah, I remember that. Yeah.
So, yeah, that was my last.
Didn't know if you're gonna go there, but
I went there.
Yeah, because that was the Legend of Prometheus edition came out, or I don't know, I guess it was December of 2020. Yeah.
Yeah, 2020. So, exactly. Yeah. 2 years almost to the date since that time. So time fucking flies, man. We've all aged and matured since then. Honestly, I think I've added fucking 10 years to my life.
Matured a lot.
Yeah, big time. So anyway, the reason we're having this conversation is obviously to talk a little bit about the Austrian edition, which you contributed the foreword and the introduction, and talk a little bit about Bitcoin Times, the ethos of it. But also, I want to talk a little bit today, and you and I have kind of touched on this in person when I was in Austin, is a discussion about the merits of democracy. I want to see sort of what your thoughts are on that. So, you weren't prepared for this, were you?
No, I wasn't. This is like gotcha journalism.
It basically is. I kind of want to compare that with, you know, the libertarian ANCAP movement, the relationship to Bitcoin, Austrian economics and stuff like that. So you'll see where I take it. But to begin with, maybe let's talk a little bit about, maybe you can just sort of give people an overview of your piece, or at least the foreword and introduction to this edition of the Bitcoin Times. And effectively what your journey was into Austrian economics, because you kind of like me came into Austrian econ through unrelated means, right? So I'd love to hear that, Jim.
Yeah. And I think first, kind of just packaging, the whole of the Bitcoin Times Austrian edition. A number of the people who contributed to it, Safe, Michael Goldstein, Pierre Rochard, each were very helpful to me on my journey to understanding Bitcoin, and kind of part and parcel to that was coming into this world of the Austrian school of thought. And so being able to write the introduction for it, I think that one of the things I talk about is that most people realistically will come to have learned about the Austrian school of thought because of Bitcoin. And then Bitcoin will actually make a lot more sense as they then find their way to reading some of the Austrian theory. And that is part of the theme of my article, but I think it's also what's important about not just the Bitcoin Times as a project in its totality, but particularly this edition of the Bitcoin Times is kind of not necessarily, you know, singularly rebooting Austrian economics. It doesn't need us and the contributors to this edition to do that. But I do think in a formal way, it will put a stamp on the fact that the connection between the ideas of Bitcoin and the Austrian school. And in the piece, having Safe, Michael, Pierre, Conrad, Tamir, yourself, that you kind of have this, and then even myself with this introduction, I feel like you have these kind of classically read and classically trained, which is certainly not me, probably not you, but more so the others. And then this other side, which is kind of, you know, you and I both came to learn and understand Austrian economics, first being introduced to Bitcoin, and can kind of present this, not necessarily like practice versus theory, but the connection of ideas and more of a layman kind of explanation, maybe even a more relatable explanation, because in my kind of connection therein, like I had gotten connected with Michael and Pierre and then got connected with Safe, but then Safe was really probably most formative to me in both kind of understanding the economics of money or what money is, why it exists, how it's evolved through history, even before he wrote the Bitcoin Standard. But then, and I don't even know if it was upon his recommendation, but he had somehow I got introduced to Austrian economics through Safe. And then in conversations with Michael and Pierre, that also kind of was very reinforced and kind of recommendations of other things to read. But my best way to describe it was that I had started to go down this rabbit hole of what is money. I've started to come around this idea that Bitcoin might be it. And then when I read my first set of what I would kind of classically consider Austrian economics, it just made sense. And that kind of part of the way that I related to it, and I talk about this in the introduction to this edition, is that I was perfectly predisposed to not necessarily not understand Bitcoin, but to reject it as an idea. If you were to describe it in theory of there's a currency with a fixed supply and nobody can manipulate it, one of the foundational, I don't want to say tenets of economics, but one of the outputs of the classic Keynesian view, it starts with this idea that some central management of the economy has a net benefit and that
the way that necessary.
Or is necessary. That the two become mutually related to each other, that an economy doesn't exist without a government helping to facilitate, you know, kind of certain functions of the economy or smooth out business cycles, as does the central bank. And so that was really the school of thought that I was classically trained in. It was like, you know, like the academic view. I can't remember exactly my economics courses, but it was like GDP equals X plus Y plus government spending, you know, and then kind of went and worked in investment banking for a period. The world started to collapse. It was very clear that something was fundamentally broken, but it was very difficult to discern exactly what. And then once I started, you know, nearly 10 years after the financial crisis in 2016, I guess 8 years, started going down the Bitcoin rabbit hole and picked up, you know, really what I picked up first was Hayek. And some who are kind of classically trained or classically read in the Austrian school, kind of Hayek to some degrees is considered someone who sacrificed on some very important principles. But I read that and it just made sense. I was like, this makes sense relative to what I was previously taught. And not so much like a singular idea, but I came to recognize the problem principally of central management of an economic system. This recognition that economic systems are incredibly complex, millions, hundreds of millions, billions of people all connected trading, and the idea that a very few number of people could have outsized influence on that. And whether it's the process of multi-trillion dollar or trillion dollar budgets, hundreds of millions of dollars or hundreds of billions of dollar deficits that the government spend that they don't have, the function of a central bank, that when you grow up or when you're educated to believe that's just the way the world works, but then you say like, wait, there's this group of people who think that no, that's not just how the way the world works, but that actually screws things up pretty significantly. And if you can apply some real world experience, I think this is the point, one of the points of your piece is that when you apply real world experience, like set academics aside, one way the world just makes more sense. And so if you're out there trial and error, building a business, responding and having to respond to market conditions, mm-hmm. not stock market conditions, but supply and demand of like, I'm delivering something, a good to the market, or people buying it, that the immediate response mechanism to then have to change or adapt is much more real in a practical setting of business than it is in an academic setting. And if you look at two schools of thought of the way the world works, of central management of the economic system and central management of the money system versus, hey, that's an incredibly complex system. There's no way for a small group of people to possibly not screw something up horribly. And here there is this thing, Bitcoin, a money supply that is decentralized, that can't be altered. And what that means is that everyone can use it on a decentralized basis without a small group of people functionally managing their economic system by central control. So my path was, I was trained in Keynesian economics in college. Of very little value to me, except for the fact that it provided me an anchor to now compare these, mm-hmm. these new ideas that I was learning about and being able to connect them to my real world experience. And that was probably beneficial to me because I had a good baseline to say, okay, I understand that other way of thinking. I understand the consequences of it. What seems more right to me based on my own real world experiences? And then that understanding of the Austrian school of thought, which like one way I would simplify, it's like, you have one group of people that believes that screwing with the money supply and centrally managing it is central to an economic system. And another group of people that are just like, humans act and respond to incentives, don't fuck with the money. Because if you do that, there will be devastating consequences. And that really helped me then reinforce the ideas around Bitcoin or see the contrast between the two economic systems. Because I really do think about it that way, that there are two economic systems competing now. And, there are two different schools of thought. And each has theories and each has people who ascribe to those theories. And now we have a market a way to test it, and that not everyone's going to consciously consider that, but in the end of the day, that's what's happening. And it won't be somebody that just wins the debate. It will be, what does the world actually adopt? Mm-hmm. What works and what doesn't?
I like what you said about the contrast. So it reminds me of, in my mid-20s, I lost my mind and decided to become a vegan. And I thought I found the holy grail of health practices. And I went to all the vegan seminars and read all the vegan books like that guy, what's his name, something John Robbins or whatever, like whose parents actually owned Baskin Robbins, and he became this whole vegan activist, and he wrote a book called Healthy at 100, and there was all these sort of so-called studies, right, done on that shit, and I drunk the Kool-Aid on that big time, went vegan, did everything, you know, and in the end proved to myself through practice, through trial and error, through experience, like I fucked up my hormones and all sorts of things being vegan, that like it gave me such an ability to talk about why not eating that way, why eating that way is such a stupidity. Like, so it's the same as sort of, you know, what you're talking about with the Keynesian economics, is you were right in that and you kind of healed yourself. And I think Seyfertin's story is largely similar. I think he had also been a professor of kind of like the Keynesian type neoclassical or, you know, new age economics. And then he realized that it was so fucking stupid. And correct me if I'm wrong, but I think part of Seyf's background was some sort of engineering, wasn't it?
Yeah, but so.
Yeah. So. And funny, actually, here's a parallel for you. So Conrad, he's actually a physiology practitioner. I think he's a chiropractor slash movement kind of person. So again, practically works with the human body and understands that it's complex, and then, you know, found his way to Austrian economics. Rahim was actually a physicist before he was an Austrian economist. So, like, you know, once again, like these kind of people that have, you know, worked and played with things in the real world find their way there. You know, me as an entrepreneur, you know, you working in the fund management space and, you know, watching everything collapse around you and thinking fucking something's wrong here. Like, each of us have sort of found our own way, and some through, you know, practice, and, you know, some sort of more through theory. But, you know, I wanted to also echo something you said in the beginning, which was this edition of the Bitcoin Times, the way I kind of see it is we talk about Austrian economics through a Bitcoin lens, but also Bitcoin through an Austrian economics lens. So it's kind of like both ways, and there's quite a number of insights in doing it that way, which I think is quite rare actually in most texts about either Bitcoin or Austrian economics. You know, they're usually separated, but this sort of was a two-way lens, which I think is going to be really useful to people when they read it.
Yeah, I think that, you know, I think obviously Seyf's written the Bitcoin Standard, and a lot of those ideas are Austrian in their basis, right? Pierre and Michael have a lot of writings. You know, yourself, everyone, there's implicitly or inherently this combination of free market, but more importantly, in my mind, this like decentralized. And also, I was talking last night at Austin Bitdevs with a few folks about how decentralization is a word that's thrown around and no one really appreciates it, but that decentralization is not trivial, and that we need ways to communicate around that. But this idea that no one is in control, and not decentralization theater, but the actual reality that if someone wanted to be in control, which people have in the past, that they've been actively demonstrated to not be in control, and that no one is genuinely in control of the Bitcoin network. And so when people are writing about these ideas and really even know formally what the Mises Institute is, other than like I've consumed a lot of things on the website, and a lot of people that I know have a lot of respect for the Mises Institute, but I'm like, okay, is there a physical spot? It's kind of like the Nakamoto Institute, except I know what the Nakamoto Institute is. But the point is that there have been a lot of writings about connecting the ideas between Bitcoin and the Austrian school, or referencing in my graduate, and suddenly referenced a lot of the readings from Hayek. And I mentioned that in the Bitcoin Times introduction, kind of my journey to Bitcoin. But really, this edition is it to me, it's like this first time there's a formal package that specifically is about connecting the ideas of Bitcoin to Austrian economics. And it will be something that doesn't just exist, you know, on a blog somewhere, that will be, yes, online, but also physically staring people in the face on coffee tables. And it's the Bitcoin Times Austrian edition. And most people, and this was the case for me, I went through, you know, kind of got my economics degree, and there's a chance that I had possibly read Mises and Hayek, but I have no recollection of it. I have no recollection of there being this idea that there was this other way of thinking, this other school of thought that, you know, kind of was, I don't want to say dominant, but that was significant in the kind of early 1900s to the mid-century. And then as the Keynesian school won out, it necessarily had to go away because the two could not coexist. They were fundamentally in opposition to each other. And one was practiced in, you know, centralization around government, government spending, continuing to expand, government playing a more active role in the economic system, central banks playing a more active role in the economic system via the money supply. But more to the point that the ideas were still out there and they never died, but they weren't taught. And so when I came across The Road to Serfdom, I was like, what is this? You know, and that my impression or my expectation, not impression, my expectation is that when the Bitcoin Times Austrian edition hits a lot of people's desks or people give it to people, that for them too, this will be the first introduction to the fact that there's this thing called the Austrian school of thought or Austrian economics. And that when the ideas that are in this are presented by six, seven different authors, if you included myself, and specifically connecting it to this other school that was in existence, what is it? Why did it go away? But what ultimately is it about, that many people will read that and not just say, oh, Bitcoin makes more sense now, but like, oh, there's this other view of the world of how this is how an economic system is supposed to work, and the consequences of the things that so many people see happening and they say it doesn't make sense and is not going to end well, but they don't have another answer or they don't have another explanation.
And I think with that, they'll sort of find that it's not just something that, you know, Bitcoin isn't just something that popped up in 2008, you know what I mean? And it's like that there's actually a whole history of thought that sort of underlies the concept of something like Bitcoin, you know, and we just happen to call our invention in this world fucking Bitcoin. You know, it could well have been called something else, but the sort of the very nature of a fixed money that is not able to be messed with by a bunch of central planners, it's sort of been an idea. You know, notwithstanding the fact that no one knew how to practically implement it, it's been a underlying theme of this entire school of thinking that, as you said, it's been just fucking ignored completely because it is incompatible with the status quo. This is sort of one thing I liked about Raheem's article, where he actually pointed out a couple other examples of, you know, Austrian thinking having had an impact in the world. Particularly the one that I liked was the sort of the early Swiss banking and sort of the private Swiss banking, and how that was like an analog version of you know, kind of like early Bitcoin in a sense, because it wasn't a digital network, it wasn't in sync, but it was kind of like this analog network of fully backed banks that weren't printing any money, that, you know, cared about privacy and enabled people to store their wealth, right? So kind of had these elements, and it hasn't been until Bitcoin where we actually, this school of thought can once again reemerge as the thing that makes sense, because the paradigm, like Bitcoin shifts the paradigm. And now in this new paradigm, you know, we can go so far as to say that Keynesian type thinking or Keynesian type behavior is actually going to get you in trouble. It's going to make you broke. It's, you know, you're going to lose reputation. You're going to fuck up. You're going to make mistakes. And it's actually going to be a net negative, versus today, in many ways, in the current paradigm of the fiat money sort of world, behaving in sort of behaving in the kind of by the decrees or by the thinking of Austrian economics has actually probably ended up making you more poor than rich. You know, like being a hardcore Keynesian in the current paradigm has probably made you extremely rich. So that kind of paradigmatic shift, I think, is going to have, you know, significant influence or a significant impact on the world, because you know, the whilst Keynesian type thinking may have made you rich in the short term, the fact is that it does so at the expense of the integrity of the system as a whole anyway. And in doing so, like, we've come to the point where the very integrity of the system is fucking gone. Like, things are barely being held together, and, you know, the pendulum swings, and I think that's really coming about now. And as you said, this is a watershed moment for Austrian economics, and, you know, and Bitcoin's kind of the wormhole that gets us through to there.
Yeah, and I think that most people will be, like, most people have never heard of Keynesian economics, right? Mm-hmm, that is also true. Mm-hmm. But the ultimate point is that they are aware of the economic system, right? Mm-hmm. They're aware of the fact that, you know, if I'm speaking to a U.S. audience, they're aware that the U.S. government spends money that it doesn't have and has a budget that's, you know, 1.2 trillion or whatever it is today. It's like, people look at that and it nauseates them. They know that it doesn't make sense. They know that there was a financial crisis, and they know, you know, at least many people that are running businesses and producing goods in the economic system, they know that there's a central bank, and that central bank prints money. And they, like, you know, I mentioned it before, but there is this line from, like, my old world where people would say, specifically about the money printing function, it was crazy. It's not going to end well, but they had to do it. And that they had to do it doesn't have any logic baked into it. There's no logical connection, but it's that they don't have another answer to what would come next or what the solution would be. That is what Bitcoin represents. But the point is that this idea of Keynes and Hayek or Keynesian and Austrian, those two words might not be known to either, but people in the economic system, the people in that produce real goods and services, they know the current systems, and they know at some level intuitively or inherently that it's broken. And that, in my experience with Bitcoin, that it's particularly those people who run businesses who are in the market and have to deal with the immediate consequences mm-hmm. of the chaos that it causes, that when they look at Bitcoin, they can see two realities at once. They can say, this system has seemed to work, but I've known that something's broken, and I know that it can't go on forever, and that that I need a lifeboat. And that when they learn about Bitcoin, they're willing to accept that, like, things have seemed to stick together somehow, you know, kind of even if unexplained, but that can't go on forever. I didn't write about it in this piece, but there are two kind of themes that I've written about in the past and gradually, and suddenly that money doesn't grow on trees, and that there ain't no such thing as a free lunch. You know, mm-hmm, for people mm-hmm. that run businesses or actually have that feedback loop of trial and error and delivering value to other people, when they're exposed to the other side of the view, the other paradigm, right, that they can relate to it and they can say, yep, that makes a lot more sense to me based on everything that I've lived in the world. Mm-hmm. And so I do think that a big part of this is going to be opening up that, like, hey, there is this whole other side of a debate. And there also isn't just another side of the debate. There is actually something, there's a vehicle that if those ideas make more sense to me, I can actually opt into it. I can help, you know, create that future. And that doesn't mean necessarily having to work on Bitcoin. It just means adopting Bitcoin. Because they know that the old world can't go on forever. So I do really think about it as it is a paradigm shift. I think oftentimes that word is overused.
Overused, totally.
Right. But when people start to consider the function of money, because that is something else that I write about in the introduction, that is the hardest thing to understand about Bitcoin. But when they do that, if one money is really replacing the other money, and money is the basis of all economic trade and coordination, you know, to a practical extent, that there cannot be a more consequential paradigm shift in an economic system than the form of money that facilitates trade and commerce and economic coordination.
It's huge. Yeah. So I want to tie it to another sort of idea, which is related to Austrian economics. And I'd love your thoughts on this is, you know, basically the libertarians and the anarcho-capitalists, right, are kind of, you know, have roots in Austrian thinking. What's your thoughts around, you know, those schools of thought? Do you ascribe to them? Yes, no? Are they good ideas, bad ideas?
I think I ascribe to the general ideas. I'm not, and again, this is one thing that, you know, when I said at the top that I came around to Austrian economics late, I kind of like read four or five different pieces and I was like, these ideas make sense to me. And then I didn't have to go back. I mean, I've read Human Action by Mises, super dense, but that once it clicked for me, once I realized it was like, it's about decentralized control of resources and that you need good money to coordinate those and that, you know, marginal centralization causes that to fracture. I was like, okay, this makes so much sense to me. I don't need to spend a lot more time reading. So I'm not as well read. Genuinely, I mentioned this in the piece, like I'm not as well read as like a Bitstein or a Pierre or a Safe or a Conrad. I might be as well read as you. I'm not 100% sure. But that so much of it made sense, and I just moved forward from there, you know, kind of continued to read different things based on suggestions. But that when it comes to the libertarian school, I'm not well read on like the libertarian principles in the sense of what a libertarian would argue is the, like, I know about the non-aggression principle, and you know, but like as a body of work or a theory or a practice, like, I just want to say from the start that I am not, you know, I haven't, you know, gone deep down the rabbit hole to, you know, be able to represent what their view of the world is. I can only share my perspective from my seat. And
worming yourself out, huh?
What's that?
Worming yourself out delicately in the beginning. I'm kidding.
No, but a couple of things, because I won't pull punches. You know, as it relates to a political party, it seems like a group that just likes to LARP and lose. Like realistically, like, you know, like it almost like seems to me from like, and this is just genuine, like it seems like people who would rather just espouse ideas and lose rather than form a winning strategy. And so it feels like a lot of LARPing. But from an ideas perspective, and one of my good friends, someone who I hope will write for the Bitcoin Times when you get around to an energy edition, but Gideon Powell, like, he always says, like, you know, like something like mud the roads, or like, who's going to build the roads, you know? So like, there's a lot of ideas that are libertarian that I think are also very consistent with Austrian economics. I think at some points it becomes pedantic or it becomes not applied in the real world of like, hey, yeah, like they, like there's a relation in my mind that is very Keynesian, which is like, in theory, all of these things, but in practice, if this is the way the world works, then you have to adapt or you have to live within reality. And so it's like, yeah, you know, like in theory, like everyone is autonomous and there is no state, but then like they use the term state and it's like, they're not anti-government, but they're anti-state. It's like, I don't really understand what the difference is. Human beings, you know, even if it's you know, people out in the country and a community of 20 people, they have to have some basis to agree on a set of rules to then enforce if someone's private property is stolen, as an example. And so I think about it as like, what are the tenets or the ideas that I am knowledgeable about that I agree with, that like respect individual rights, respect private property, while not well learned around the non-aggression principle, like recognizing that that, you know, kind of as a general approach makes sense. But that then when it goes into this idea of like world without borders or like, you know, and I know that anarcho-capitalism doesn't mean like chaos, that it's, you know, voluntary order, but you still need a basis. You still need a set of rules and a set of standards. If people are going to even have private property to agree on what the consequences are, if those rights are infringed upon it's like, how do you organize or how you form a consensus of a set of rules to govern people in the real world? And so like, I ultimately think that if you think about those ideas libertarians should look at Bitcoin and be like, this is the only way. In my experience, it's been this like breakdown of like, they, you know, it's almost like when I talk about it, like the in theory breaking down is like, there are these libertarians like Eric Voorhees that it's like, hey, if you get defrauded, you know, that was your own fault. And it's like, well, hey, how is that not a principle of aggression? Right. Because what fraud is intent to take my shit or intent to get me to do something with false pretenses. Intent is a very critical part of fraud. But so if somebody runs a crypto scam, as an example, whether they, you know, I mean, most problematically, if it's knowingly, if it's like, you know, there's in my perspective, there's this libertarian view, which says, well, you know, you got burned by it. You need to learn the consequences of it. But if you intended to deceive me, if you intended to defraud me, like, you know, there's certain people that want to allow snake oil salesmen to walk around their, you know, their town, and there's other people who don't. And fraud is fraud. And so that's one example of where like the libertarian ideas in my mind, like in practice, break down. Because it's like, well, you know, everyone's free to do everything, but it's like, no, we actually do need a way to set a set of rules to govern a group of people, and people should be able to voluntarily opt into that. But it doesn't remove the need for a common standard or a common set of rules in a way to enforce them. And then what we're disagreeing about is just like the form of government and who and how those rules get enforced and how it's paid for. If that makes sense.
Yeah, I think the way I've, because it is tricky, my late entry into sort of Austrian econ and, you know, libertarian type thinking, ANCAP thinking, you know, I had a lot of trouble with that sort of move from, you know, the theoretical basis of everyone, you know, can do what they want, we have private property, but, you know, how is that implemented and enforced? And I think the best stuff I found around that comes from, you know, Hopper and Rothbard in the discussions around like contracts. You know, people have contracts between each other. And, you know, when you break a contract, then there's recourse. So I think in a...
Right, but how is the recourse enforced? Because if the recourse is just you walking up and shooting somebody, then everybody else says, well, now was another social contract broken? Like, was your you know, economic contract broken, and does that just justify you being able to shoot the other person? Right,
I guess it depends what it says in the contract.
So if it doesn't say I get to shoot you if you defraud me of my money, then like,
you know, maybe it'll say like, you know, I have to make you whole, for example, kids into slavery or something.
Mind, it becomes turtles all the way down, because you can put my kids into slavery, but like if everyone is enforcing the rules on a one-to-one basis and there's no commonality as to like what, like, and this is the theoretical example that I always use. It's like, imagine I go out into the wilderness where no one's inhabited and I build a fort and I say, if you want to come into my fort, here are a set of rules. And if you do not live by them, I get to, this is how they're enforced. Do you agree to that consent? Do you agree to that contract? Do you agree to that consensus? Yes. But like, you still need a way to enforce it. Right. Because it's like, if it doesn't say, you know, this is our contract, and if it says you break it and then I'm just shit out of luck, right, then why would anybody honor a contract? You know, so like, that's the place.
So the issue here is the enforcement of the consequences of the contract, right?
I mean, it's just like that. There's the contract exists with it, would inherently need to exist within some social construct. Otherwise, it's functionally meaningless. I do think we're getting a little bit off talk of the Austrian school, but I'm willing to entertain you on this. but you know, that overarching point is that and the way I would relate it to this is that in many ways, these theoretical, like in theory, we should be able to have a central bank that manipulates the money supply in some people's minds, not mine, and that can work. In practice, it's broken. In theory, this idea of a digital money that has a finite supply doesn't work because it's too out there and hard for people to understand. In practice, it works. In theory, wouldn't it be nice if just every individual had contracts? But that's not the way that the actual world works. And there's actually a lot of practice in history of like looking at the state of Texas. It's like state of Texas, 30 million people, and it has very strong property rights. And those property rights are enforced by a structure of government that everyone has agreed to, not everyone, but that people have agreed to. And what is the outcome of that? 6 million barrels of oil a day gets produced. The only way that happens is that there are property rights, private property rights, and there's a construct to enforce them if it is broken. You do not get, in practice, 6 million barrels of oil produced and refined a day if you do not have property rights that allow people to go innovate. And it comes back as if you do not have a money that functionally works, you can't produce oil either. But but really, like the way I would relate it to the ideas that we're talking about before, these like in theory versus in practice, and what has worked in practice and the empirical record of that versus the ideas in theory, and trying to kind of like steer it towards, okay, practical application, you know, what's the world that has worked, because producing massive amounts of energy at scale and having good money to be able to coordinate those economic resources, to me is,
it's tricky. Coordination at scale is tricky. It's very, very tricky. Sorry to cut you off there, but I think, you know, I just want to echo something that I also have trouble with, you know, the idea of contract enforcement. I think that is, it's a very difficult thing. This is sort of where I actually end up falling away from the ANCAP movement, and maybe didn't know this, but you know, I kind of think about the fort analogy that you used, is that the fort itself is a piece of private property in which you know, you have a, and this kind of feels like a monarchy to me, is that the idea of you have the king lays out the fucking law, and you live within that domain, and that's the contract you ascribe to. And I think that is the most natural governance we've ever had.
No, but I think that's where I disagree. It's like, just you assumed that because I built the fort that it was mine and I set the rules, but I might sit there and say, what is the thing that's going to, like, all it means is that there's this area and I have to determine what the rules are, how the rules get set, how the rules change in a way that's going to best align with my own interests. And what the American experiment was creating a different way to set rules and change it. Because while I might go and set up a fort, if I want to attract a dude to come drill oil in my fort and me to be able to benefit from that, and I don't have the skill set to be able to drill oil myself, I might need to create a system that that person can rely upon to allow that person to innovate and have ownership and not feel like it's a subject. So it's just a difference of how you organize people, how you can govern, and how you can do that in a way that results in the most positive outcomes. And it's also a world of trial and error, right? So to assume in that analogy that the way that the rules get set is just by dictate, it's like, no, that's one way. And now there's this other way where not a single person is in control. And in that way, it is inherently more decentralized. And that if you're going to coordinate more people and more resources and allow for more innovation, in the sense of, I think at a principles level, the incentive for someone to take risk and then to benefit from that, that there needs to be a way to not have a single person in control or a small group of people in control. And what's functionally happened with our economic structure and our governance structure in the United States is that a system that was designed to be highly decentralized and was resilient to a lot of centralizing forces became less resilient to centralizing forces when the money became entirely co-opted. And so my view of it is, before we throw the baby out with the bathwater, let's fix the money. Let's take the fly out of the ointment. Let's see where the chips fall and then figure out what else we need to change. But that it would be naive to throw out this radical idea that did result really in the first time of people living in a world where they're not subjects at scale. Not to say that there weren't other agrarian systems that try different areas or ideas, but that this idea that you're not the subject of somebody else and that this is how we're going to make decisions and we're going to have a few foundational ideas that are rights that are not subject to people's voting to change. Or if they are, they require overwhelming, you know, like an inherently decentralized system to make it very difficult to change. Because when you think about those commonalities to Bitcoin, it is, when we talk about Bitcoin and it's 21 million fixed supply, and that's why it's valuable, and it's a form of money that can't be manipulated, it is because the system is inherently hard to change. Mm-hmm. It is decentralized, and that decentralization, which is not trivial, is structurally set up to prevent change. Because if you could change something critical to how the 21 million is enforced, then the 21 million is at risk. And the way I think about the ideas or the structure of government in the United States and how it relates to Bitcoin is that it was set up to be very difficult to change or to alter these core principles that aren't subject to vote. And that I'm not, you know, I have enough humility to look at it and say, like, there was a lot of prosperity that this drove, and then something changed and it was the fucking money and it got broken. And as it got broken, then the things that preserve this decentralized structure was the security hole. And we fucked up the money centralized, the money supply became 100% centralized. That allowed for the government functions to centralize. Let's go the order of operations. Let's unfuck the money and then come back to the governance structure if we need to. But it might just work as intended, because I don't think that the people that put that framework in place as a different idea or different way to organize or set rules or change rules conceived of a world where the money supply could be entirely co-opted.
That is fair. So I agree in order of operations for sure. My guess though is that these sort of these republic or shared shared directorship, I guess, for lack of a better term. These kind of states, I think, are very difficult to manage, because you end up, you know, the thing about not being a subject to a king, for example, you end up being a subject to a group of bureaucrats, because, you know, the sort of the governance structure just shifts from, you know, a strong leader with a support group to a group of bureaucrats who often become, you know, popularity contest leaders, as opposed to,
I think in a world of centralization, yes. Right. And because those bureaucrats only have control to the extent that they have increasingly centralized ability to influence outcomes. And that wasn't always the case. And one way that I, you know, have one example that I'd have to go back and find it, but there was this great, because it's not really about like the structure of government, but it is kind of core to the kind of the ideas of incentives. And there was this talk that the CEO, I don't think he's currently the CEO, but CEO of AT&T gave about the differences in telecom networks in the United States versus telecom networks in Europe, and that you had not just more regulatory regimes, but that the way that bandwidth was structured in terms of private property or ownership of that was basically in Europe leased and in the United States owned. And he talked about the difference in outcomes from ownership economics versus the outcomes from renter economics. Mm-hmm. And that if somebody owns something, then they
treat it completely differently.
They treat it differently. They conserve the resource, they develop the resource. Mm-hmm. And then the question becomes, if that is the case, it's like, what, how do you set incentives to allow people to operate in the quote best way possible? It's one of the ideas that Hayek talks about, is that like the economic system, the price mechanism, is one of the central points of my introduction, is this thing that allows for the abstraction away from conscious control. And that, like, how can you create the incentives to get people to do the quote right things without knowing that they're doing the right things? And that's all about incentives. And that it does come to this idea, I think, at the probably most fundamental level, is how can you create an environment where people have the greatest ownership incentives and economics to allow them to develop the resources that are in front of them for not only their own benefit, but for those around them. And I think you just have to look at, you know, historical track records, empirical evidences, to not say there's no one size fits all, but there is empirical evidence, and people can choose which systems they would rather prefer, and then they have to deal with the consequences of those decisions.
Yeah, I mean, you, in a way, there you're making the argument for what ANCAP suggests, which is resources and things and stuff should be owned by, you know, the people operating these things, and then the decision with what to do with those things is better made at the edges, right? Like, you know, with the person who is owning as opposed to renting. And I guess this is where you have a difficulty in what I said, is modern governance has kind of morphed into this renter type economics, because people in office are renters, people who are voted in are renters,
yeah, it was one thing that I didn't finish that idea. I'll find it, maybe you can put it in the show notes, but it was this idea that if you have renter economics, then you consume, mm-hmm, rather than if you own, then you conserve and
you conserve,
develop,
yeah,
and maximize, totally, yeah. And that if you have this renter dynamic and a lack of ownership, then what consumption means is just draining resources. Like, mm-hmm, it's not replenishing it or not conserving it or not maximizing it. because there is a very different dynamic if you're just extracting everything you can from somebody else's resource rather than developing your own.
Yeah, that's at scale, that becomes basically a tragedy of the commons, right? So this is the problem with, for example, public property versus private property. Public property is effectively rented property, and it always suffers from a tragedy of the commons, which is why there's a very big difference between the kind of park you see that's run by a rich person who owns the park and pays for his own cleaners and shit like that, and it's private, versus the public park, which has fucking junkies and shit like that sleeping in there because it's public.
I really think about that too, is like this idea of like private and public. Like, I think it's become very contrasted because of the size of the government apparatus, but it really becomes more of a question of size and locality, right? Because if you, you know, in theory, if you have 10 people that have plots of land out and they want to like develop a park together, it's like, is that really public or is it just like shared and common use? And if there's 10 people, maybe it works because everybody has a more direct incentive to ensure that the common resource is developed. And it's not necessarily to say that nobody owns it. It's like in the city of Austin, like the city of Austin owns the, you know, some parkland. Well, if it becomes too big, maybe it's this collective action failure where there's a tragedy of the commons, but that the tragedy of the commons is probably more so something based on scale than it is.
Yeah.
And what the resource is, you know, it is an interesting idea when it comes back to Bitcoin, of the idea, you know, and I'll just bring it up because you brought up the idea of tragedy of the commons. But one of the ways that Bitcoin eliminates the tragedy of the commons is the fixed block space. Everyone has to figure out the best way to use it, and there's direct economic cost associated with it. I think there's a lot of ways that, you know, humans might organize differently now that they have a different form of money. And there's no way to, you know, there's principles to understand incentives to say like directionally this is the way that the world will likely go, but it's also impossible to predict because everyone now has a new resource that has fundamentally different principles than have existed for at least everyone who's alive today's, you know, past experiences.
Yeah, I think what you said there about scale is super important, because that's where I think everything's going awry. And this actually comes back to the problem you mentioned in the beginning, which is the money printer being the fuck up, is that the centralization of the money supply and then the distortion as to where money goes has actually given us the illusion that we can do things at scale which are actually otherwise unprofitable or uneconomical, or that we shouldn't have actually done in the first place. And I think that's the big aha moment, that, as you said, you know, as we fix the money piece downstream, we're going to realize that, hey, maybe running a state the size of Texas is actually a fucking really poor economic decision. You know, maybe this should be broken down further such that, you know, there's probably going to be a maximum size, I shouldn't even use the word maximum, maybe like an ideal size territory that is economically most feasible. And I think that's also going to vary by people, by religion, by culture, by race, by all those sorts of things, because some people might be more inclined to, you know, have cooperative behavior. Others might be more competitive. And I think it's going to be very interesting to see, you know, the ramifications of that down the track, because, you know, maybe that optimum size of a state is going to vary. And I'm just spitballing here, but it's probably going to vary depending on culture, even probably depending on temperature, like where you are in the world. You know, there's a whole theory around like why Switzerland became Switzerland and still resembles remnants of what medieval Europe was before, you know, the French Revolution, all that sort of stuff, and why Switzerland remains prosperous today despite all of the destruction and, you know, socialization inherent in Europe. And so, yeah, I think, you know, location, culture, you know, territory, temperature, or weather and all that sort of stuff, I think are going to have an interesting impact on what the size of these territories are going to be in order to remain economically feasible. And my guess is that they're probably going to be operated more like companies, I think, than collectives. You know how you've got the hippies that want to always, you know, do a social good company, and they have like every employee gets a say, and the motherfuckers never get anything done because, you know, it's like it becomes death by committee. Versus, you know, the better companies, you know, have really strong leadership, and, you know, like a good leader who kind of marks the direction and they move. So anyway, just spitballing some thoughts there.
Yeah, I do agree with that. It's like, I think that there's going to be, you know, as there has been throughout history, there's going to be trial and error. People are going to put forward different ideas of ways to organize. It's going to be, you know, those are going to be informed by culture and what people value, and religion is tied to that. And that different systems will likely be able to scale in different ways, based on the ideas and the ability to enforce or ensure that the social constructs that people believe that they're shared or committed to are actually what happens in practice, and that the social contracts don't become broken, and at some size and scale for each, they probably do.
Mm-hmm. I want to ask a question. Do you think there's a risk in your mind that we do fuck up, like, along the way, like, and what I mean by fuck up is, like, I don't know, somehow things get more and more clown worldish, you know, CBDCs roll out, you know, Bitcoin doesn't, you know, amass enough economic momentum. You know, what do you think we need to be aware of or careful of as we venture into this decade?
I think that it's like humans have demonstrated an ability to fuck things up in the past. So to, you know, it's kind of like to think that it's not possible would be devoid of some humility. Mm-hmm. But that I think when, you know, if you come back to incentives of what money affords, and I think that that is something that not a lot of people have an appreciation for, because it's been taken for granted. It's been there, it's worked. But it is ultimately an economic resource that people need to continue their way of life, you know, especially in the developed world. Just power, clean water, basic healthcare, food, showing up at their doorstep without having to put in much effort. That's all tied to the function of money. And so I think that I think over time, and as Bitcoin's achieved the scale that it has, that it's not possible for any single group to screw it up, because of the, and that's on a spectrum, obviously, like, you know, if we could never anchor to some principle, then it would always be turtles all the way down, and we could never function. We could not put one foot in front of the other. But on the spectrum, that's like, if somebody changes something in Bitcoin, or if, quote, something gets screwed up, that the incentive to have a form of money that can't be printed is so great to so many people that if something changes somebody or something, somebody else has the ability to not follow or to put forward a better idea, that based on the fact that Bitcoin is decentralized and becomes more and more decentralized over time from effectively each point forward as more people adopt it, that it becomes harder and harder for either somebody to have outsized influence in a harmful way or to not have resources to put forward solutions that allow for either errors to be overcome or to put forward solutions that continue to make it a more and more valuable system. But that it is anchored to that idea of, like, you know, ultimately humans have a survival instinct and survive in, you know, natural and very hard conditions to get to this point, to think that they won't take a resource and develop it to ensure survival when you think about the consequences of it. It's hard for me to believe that that happens, or to put that under the spectrum of possible to the degree that we have to worry about it. And that's perfectly consistent with the idea of saying like, yeah, it's also like there is a possibility, but if people worked within that reality of essentially paralysis, because, you know, every possibility prevents action, that not only is that consistent with the way the world works, but it's also not a great way to live.
Mm-hmm. Do you think though, so let's just not say it's paralysis. Let's say we don't fuck up Bitcoin. Let's say, you know, Bitcoin keeps doing its thing, getting bigger, but somehow, I don't know, the level of stupidity and apathy in the world in general, because I mean, I think we've seen a lot of that in the past 2 years. I mean, I'm
back, is it South greater America. But is it greater than degree of other things in history?
You mean a greater percentage of apathy and stupidity, you mean, than previous times?
No, I'm not trying to quantify apathy and stupidity. I'm just saying in terms of different points in history of people demonstrating an ability to be whether rational or irrational, doing some very devastating things, right? And that we also now have tools to prevent that, you know? So it's like, if I look at it in a relative perspective of like, you know, going back to World War I, World War II, you know, Civil War in the United States, like, There have been times of great stress, you know, bubonic plague, like human beings have survived massive periods of uncertainty.
Mm-hmm.
And then thinking about it on where we exist today, now that we have this tool Bitcoin, to say like, is it possible that the world goes back to the Stone Age? Yeah, like, always possible, but the incentives are set such that the first one being survival exists in such a way that make that highly unlikely, especially now that we have a tool like Bitcoin and we know the benefits of oil and natural gas and coal and power and you know, healthcare and antibiotics, like, then, you know, like, there's just so much more that we know about the world. And if humans have survived in the past without the resources that we have today, to think that we screw our present state of the world up more so than things have been screwed up in the past with very limited resources, it's just hard. It's hard to conceive of that. And it's also, if you want to go be hopeful for the future and build and, you know, kind of, it's like, I think the answer is no. And I think if people, you know, kind of harp on that and have a pessimistic view, then like, that's rather than one of, you know, survival, freedom, whatever tenets you ascribe to, that the incentives say no. But
let me rephrase it then. So I think we have less of a risk of going into a Stone Age, more like a modern digital gulag. Honestly, I think that's probably a bigger risk. Where you sort of have like a, you know, a very controlled sort of sanitized life. And my personal concern, and again, I err towards optimism that this may not be the case, because, you know, I do meet people like you and, you know, Bitcoiners and, you know, and even non-Bitcoiners, you know, on a daily basis that are, you know, strong of character and strong of will. So like, the human spirit is very hard to kill. But I think we live in an age where humans are fundamentally weaker than they have been in all of history. You know, you mentioned World War II, World War I. You know, a lot of the strong leaders, the strong men of those days, they all got fucking killed on the battlefield. Now, they were very different to the kind of people that are kind of surrounding us today. You know, like the average male, like even if we want to pull out the testosterone level, just as an example, it was more than double or triple 100 years ago. Like, it was a very different type of energy that came from humans. And particularly the further back we go, the more I think morally, physically, psychologically strong we were than we are now. Because I think in some cases, material wealth is a, you know, or material strength in the material realm can often translate into weakness in the spiritual and moral realm, you know, because people just naturally become softer. It's happened with every single empire in the past, you know, whether it was the Persians, whether it was the Romans, whether it was you fucking name it. The more materially affluent they became, the weaker and softer they became. And then they got, you know, toppled by someone, you know, harder, tougher, right. and more spite in nature.
And so is anything really different, right? Because I get the idea that you're talking about, and I do think, and it's like, in certain ways, it's impossible not to, right? To a relative degree, like when you have a home that has power, that has clean water, you go to the grocery store, you focus on other things. Right. Mm-hmm, people are, even in our current construction of our lives, like people face different stressors, and, you know, it's impossible to predict. It's impossible how I would predict in a period of, like, you know, an economic depression, or how you exactly would, or how, you know, person 3, 4, 5,000 million do, but that in the face of those stressors, it also does strengthen people, mm-hmm. and that there is that incentive both to survive and to move forward. And so it's impossible to predict who survives those elements, but what naturally would come is that overall, in the face of those stressors, that collectively people become strong. You know, it's like on a relative perspective, people become stronger in response to stressors. And so again, like that, if that is a principle that has always been true, that it will also continue to be, that it's okay. It's not coincidence.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So I agree with the stressor part. You know, if the stressor is strong enough, basically it reawakens, you know, the human spirit and it
doesn't mean that everybody, like me, you, you know, some, you know, you don't know who, you know, who actually becomes stronger versus who succumbs to the challenges, but
totally.
But overall, like, people adapt and adapt to survive and carry forward.
What if the stressor is not present? Because see, and we're getting to the core of where I think the risk is, and this nuance I think is very important, is that, you know, in the past, the stresses have been real, you know, starvation, et cetera, like from communism and all this sort of shit, right? And then people end up revolting and, you know, bringing the walls down. You know, what if, you know, people are so fucking numbed out of their minds with, you know, cloud kitchen, food delivery, Netflix, weed, fucking you name whatever stupidity that, you know, sort of exists today, particularly in the, you know, this is probably more prevalent in the West, but, you know, where people don't actually experience the stressor and they end up walking into a gulag, a digital gulag, without even fucking knowing it, because they're not stressed enough to push back or to wake up.
Right. So, but that's talking about at a unit level or an individual level, right? Mm-hmm. And so, and then the question would be, like, how is that different from some, you know, different form of gulag in the past, right? And that some people walked into it and other people saw it coming, and even some people that saw it coming, you know, didn't survive, but mm-hmm. as a whole people did. And that when we think about Bitcoin, what Bitcoin represents, it's like, yeah, some people will walk into that digital gulag, right? But now we have, but if we think about where we are at a point in time and going forward, it's like Bitcoin changes people more than people change Bitcoin, that there is a tool to facilitate economic coordination. There is a path to opt out. And from this point forward, more people will figure that out. Mm-hmm. And that will become a mechanism to to ensure that that whatever, even if there's turbulence in the future and economic instability or economic disruption as kind of this current economic system gets to its kind of final stages, that like my perspective or my view on the world is just that like this tool now exists and it will allow for more peaceable economic coordination, and that some people will see it coming, some people will adapt, others won't. But I don't see a lot of benefit of trying to scenario plan for every last possible scenario, because we live in the present rather than the future. Mm-hmm. And we take the actions that will, you know,
make sense today. Yeah.
Yeah. And that enough people have the incentive to not walk into a gulag. And again, it's like, you know, just using a simplistic number, but yes, that's a lot of people, but it's far from everyone. And like, there is a reality that when people wake up to Bitcoin, that they also start thinking about different, like how incentives have been broken, what the consequences of those are, and what they might do differently. And so to think that that trend changes and that that doesn't have some positive impact, it's like, you know, there's people that sit on their couch and play Xbox. And that's, I mean, like, I like to play FIFA, but I haven't played it in years. So I'm not just like, you know, throwing all gamers under the bus, but there's actual people that are out there drilling oil right now. Right.
Totally. Yeah.
And like 5 million barrels a day get produced just in the state of Texas. Like there's a lot of people who put in real hard work. Like I remember just like to use an analogy to this, you know, scenario, which was a couple of years ago in Texas, we had this crazy, like literal never happened in my life before, massive snowstorm. And it wasn't just a snowstorm, but the snow remained on the ground and it basically put the power grid into a position where it nearly failed. And there's these LARPers on Twitter who I think are the people that you're talking about, who are like, you know, kind of using it as an opportunity to be like, ah, oh, Texas, this, you know, libertarian conservative passion, like they can't even get their power right. And then like what I was thinking about was, in 20 degree weather when the power was shutting down, there were people out there who knew how to fix the fucking power system so that, you know, thousands of people didn't die, you know? So at the same time that there are people that won't see it coming, there's other people that have real skills that actively, you know, put forward products and services and solutions.
Alternatives,
that have a net benefit to, you know, we have that maximum incentive. So, you know, we could all head for the hills or, you know, figure out ways to make each individual person, you know, like I have an incentive to make my life better, you, yours, each person does. It doesn't mean that everyone follows that incentives, but I think there's a lot of empirical evidence to say that like as a whole, we become stronger, we in the general sense of just like
the human spirit,
and the ability to produce new things and have, you know, access to information that then allows people to act on incentives in ways that differed before. And so you know, having all of that incremental knowledge just makes it less and less that in totality something fundamentally breaks down.
Okay. I mean, my only other question was going to be, do you think the world sort of splits largely into two groups, like a CBDC world and a Bitcoin world? You know, do you think that's likely, or do you think it's too complicated and intertwined for there to be such a disparity?
No, I don't think so. I think that far too much consternation is put forward with this whole idea of like the CBDC, because like it's functionally no different than the system that exists today. Like, is it technically different? Could it make the current system marginally worse? Yes, but people need to eat and people need power. And people need water and people have wants that will make their lives better. And I view the current system as so fractured and fragile and kind of massively unstable that to think that this last gasp, all it is there's a trust-based system, and that is the legacy economic system and the fiat currency system. It's already trust-based. They already print a lot of money. The consequences of that, the bodies are buried. And so it will always be a contrast between a trust-based system and a trustless system. Current iteration of the dollar and the Fed and a CBDC version of the dollar, they are the same.
Same thing.
Yeah. Functionally. And the Bitcoin is the only thing that is really contrasted to it in a way that's credible and that can provide an alternative. And so there are going to be people in that last gasp that latch onto it, right? There's going to be some people who go down with a ship that think like, if only more centralization, this would be better. Mm-hmm. If we just do socialism mm-hmm. better, this would be better. And there's going to be other people that are responding to economic incentives. And at the end, kind of ultimately, there's going to be a form of money that fails to facilitate trade and economic coordination. And the consequence of that is not in theory. It's like if you are holding a form of money that fails, you cannot get the most basic of necessities that you need to sustain yourselves. So everyone will have the maximum incentive, and even governments need to eat. And that's the thing that I think people miss. Like the government's going to need Bitcoin too. Like mm-hmm. when the currency fails, like they lose their power, but they still have certain functions that they want to preserve or need to preserve in their minds. And there's no routing around the fact that people need money to coordinate activity. So mm-hmm. likely some structures of government will change on a Bitcoin standard, because if the government's going to be funded, it's going to have to be taxed. People don't like to be taxed, and they've printed money as a way to really avoid taxing that. People. Mm-hmm. But there is this recognition, or at least my view of the world, is that the governments are going to need good money too. And the ones that respect the rights of property and other social contracts the best are going to attract the most Bitcoin, the most sound money, and those places are going to benefit the most, and others aren't. But there's not going to be this like fractured split. It's going to be people intuitively recognize that they need to trade, and they're going to seek out the tools that allow them to best do that. So to think that there's like, that there's not distributions of all those people in the world that recognize that and adapt, and that others get dragged along. That doesn't map to me. It doesn't mean that like a government can't totally screw up their economic system and that wealth can't be destroyed and that wealth won't have to be recreated. But there is a tool and everyone's going to figure it out.
I hope so, man. I hope so. I think sometimes, I had this epiphany when I went to Europe, is like the Twitter bubble kind of gets you caught up in thinking the end of times are near. And then, you actually realize that things are a bit more complicated than that. Even in the midst of, catastrophe in World War I and World War II, people still actually ate and people still did stuff. And, when I went to Europe recently, like, I went there thinking that Europe was going to be falling apart and everything was going to be upside down and all this sort of shit. It was fucking pumping, dude. Like the restaurants were full, people were out. Like, yeah, food was more expensive, and transportation was a little bit more expensive.
Same experience going to LA for Pacific Bitcoin, where I was like, this is the apocalypse, not in the true apocalyptic sense, but it was like, this is like these places are still locked down, or they're all wearing masks or whatever. And I went out there, I was like, oh, this is pretty normal. Like,
it's not that bad.
Some of that was informed by, going to some places during the lockdown that were less free mm-hmm. and open than Texas. But mm-hmm. like, it is also that, like, uh, like people respond to incentives, and you know, it is probably, you know, if not maximally important, probably most important that there's a wide group of people that like generally believe and value the same things, and like and mm-hmm. even if there's some mass psychosis that they're, you know, there are incentives that drive people to do certain things, and if put forward with better ideas or better solutions, that like people will seek those out, and that you know, like you said, in like times when there's been great challenges, like people survive, like it's not as bad, you know. And I think that I'm reading or actually watching a documentary series called The Prize on the history of oil, and like I think that one of the recognitions is that we think about the past as archaic, and it's not, you know, like mm-hmm. you see like the things that were being built in the 1800s, but first totally. What the conception of it was like, no, like we're a little bit naive when we think back just as a function of history and time, but that ultimately it's driven by incentives and people's will and kind of all of those things. So there's a lot of reason to be hopeful, and I do think that you know it's all directional, right? And that it's not like Bitcoin isn't, you know, sometimes the way I even describe it can sound like a panacea. It's not, but it is a tool. Mm-hmm. And it is a resource, and more people are going to figure it out. And there is going to be uncertainty, but a world where there's a tool that exists to help coordinate resources and facilitate trade when others are breaking down, that's better than the alternative.
Correct. Correct. Yes, very much so. All right, man. Well, look, this was a really good call. Is there anything that you want to sort of mention in closing this out?
Just bringing it back full circle on what we started off on is just the Austrian edition of the Bitcoin Times. And that when you had talked to me earlier in the year about expanding the vision for the Times, I thought that was really important. I was personally really proud to have contributed to edition 3. It was the last one of my graduate and suddenly pieces. I've actually focused on that, turning that into a book now, and I've actually worked on another piece that will be coming out in a week because I just mm-hmm. wanted to write. And that when I think about the Times and what I think it is and ultimately can be, is that the median itself, and there were a couple things that, you know, we've talked about this in the past, but I want to share with the listeners because I think people should really not just buy the collectibles, but understand what the Times is. There's books and there's blogs, but there's magazines. But the way I started to think about the Times was it's something that you get six or seven different people to write on a theme, and that is a functionally different medium, and that people can share that, and it can be consumed in a different way that a magazine is consumed, or a different way mm-hmm. that a book is consumed, but that the content, and I think it's the content kind of with each piece that's in this one, is that it's geared to being timeless, to being focused on principles, and that it will be a powerful mechanism that people can share, where I think about the idea of giving the Bitcoin Times to somebody, particularly in the collectible form, where it's sitting on someone's coffee table, beautifully designed, built like to the materials, to the pieces themselves, in a way where if you give that to somebody, someone could pick up someone could pick up and read an article by Safety, and they could set it down and come back and read an article by Michael Goldstein, and do the same with Pierre, read multiple at the same time, and they can be exposed to the ideas put forward individually by people who have a lot of very valuable ideas, and then collectively as a work, being exposed to a range of ideas by a range of authors going deep on a particular theme or subject. And I think mm-hmm. that is of value, particularly in this kind of adoption phase of Bitcoin, of exposing more people in different ways to ultimately distribute ideas and knowledge. And so I'm really excited for, you know, kind of, I've read all of the articles, people should as well, but also recognizing that the Bitcoin Times and what you're working on is an important project, and that more people need to know about it, more people need to kind of come to appreciate, and that they will just by, you know, kind of getting the physical copies in their hands and being able to share that with, you know, friends and family. So just kind of want to reinforce that then when,
thank you.
I got the chance to write the introduction, which it was really forward, and then I sat down and just started writing and kind of fucked it up and turned it into a piece itself. And thank you for adapting, because I did want to have something that I was proud of as part of this. And it was an honor to write it, because not just that Safe and yourself and Michael and Pierre, but also I over you know, kind of, you know, whether it was like the last 6 months, but being able to sit down and read a piece by people who I do not know personally, it was kind of like I was reading more from the outside on them, but mm-hmm. people who I was also aware of, and to be able to kind of put a packaging around it and be able to contribute an introduction to it. I personally wanted to have something memorable in this edition of the Bitcoin Times, and I look forward to others, but that my expectation is that people will read this edition or a prior edition, and it will become something that actively people want, you know, when there's a theme that fits their skill set, that it will be a source of pride to contribute, that people will want to have contributed to an edition of the Times, and that, you know, going from an individual essay in one Times to a work as a whole, to the Times as a broader kind of vision and mission, is that the collective will be the set of ideas that were written at a point in time that carried forward, demonstrated to be true, that I think that this type of writing and this type of work will be something that that more people do, and that will expand the ideas of Bitcoin. And the other thing that I recognized was that and I did this to the credit of the guys at the Bitcoin Magazine, that when they started really improving the quality and standard of their print. Physical work, that I realized that on a Bitcoin standard, print will come back. You know, a lot of things are manufactured and built in a way to be consumed and thrown away. Mm-hmm. And people think of this idea of print as a dead medium, but really it's a better way to consume content and to consume a set of ideas, and that if you built something to last, which the Times is, that people will buy it, hold on to it, and pass it on. Mm-hmm. And so I think that, you know, when we talk, that the part of the inspiration wasn't just that I had contributed to the Times digitally in 2020, which we mentioned at the beginning, but that having, you know, held something physical that was a quality, not just the content, but the quality of material, it was like, that's something I want to hold on to. And that if you do that in a different medium like the Times, that similarly that will have not just a place, but a big place. So I'm really excited for this edition to come out in its full package, and for the ideas to spread, and then to also see where the Times goes from here.
Thanks, man. Yeah, I can't wait to like have a physical copy in my hands, because McKenna did a fucking incredible job with this one as well, man.
Shout out to McKenna. He is incredibly talented, and with your vision and his vision, I see it improving from edition to edition, and that's certainly true of the Austrian edition.
Thank you. And dude, my biggest thanks as well for like being one of the people that kind of gave me a kick in the ass to actually do something with it, because it was, you know, just sort of sitting there as a little hobby. So I appreciate you, you know, giving me that impetus and that inspiration. It means a lot. So, all right, man. Well, for everyone listening, I mean, you all know Parker's Twitter handle, Parker A. Lewis, isn't it? It's Parker A. Lewis, right?
Yeah.
On Twitter?
That's right.
Yep. And then, and have you got a site for Gradually Then Suddenly? Like, is it Gradually Then Suddenly?
Not yet, but I'm working on it. Okay. The articles are currently, they're in two places principally. You can find them on the Unchained blog at unchained.com. If you go to the blog, there's a GTS series, a Gradually and Suddenly series. And then also they're on the Nakamoto Institute. So you can find them on the Nakamoto Institute too.
Beautiful. So get out there, do that. Grab a copy of the Bitcoin Times edition 5. Grab one of edition 3, which Parker was a part of and did, I think, one of the literal all-time great pieces. Bitcoin is the great definancialization, which I think is such an important topic because I don't think people actually realize that by Bitcoin being this incredible, for lack of a better term, perfect money, like it's actually going to help definancialize the world. Refinancialize it or add extra financialization to it. We're probably going to go through a phase of that, but it'll simplify the world. And that's actually what we need. We have too much complexity and obfuscation and abstraction. And I think this is something that a lot of people have trouble with understanding. And it was one of the basically the best answers to that concept and question that I've ever seen written. So that's edition 3. And edition 5. So anyway, dude, thank you so much for coming on. This was a great episode.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you for listening to the Wake Up Podcast. Find us on the Fountain app and send us a boost with a comment. I'll try and read them each week and send you a shout out. And remember to grab a copy of the Uncommunist Manifesto and join us in defeating plague that is consuming our world.